Performing weddings is another major function of the pastor. I now say perform the wedding instead of I married Julie Smith because it was beginning to sound like I was married to many women. And I didn't marry Julie Smith. I simply performed her wedding ceremony. The wedding is a joyous occasion filled with excited and nervous individuals who want things to go smoothly. As a pastor, your expertise and experience regarding the wedding ceremony will be looked upon to provide calm direction and guidance for the wedding party. So increasing one's competency in this area can help you be a tremendous blessing for many people during this important aspect of their lives. Most ministers agree that marriage is held in high esteem by God, and our view of marriage really should reflect God's view of marriage. Marriage is seen as honorable, and it is seen as blessed. Hebrews 13:4 states, "Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers God will judge." The apex of marriage is seen in Ephesians chapter 5, where Paul describes the husband-wife union as the highest type of human relationship, which symbolizes the relationship Christ has with his bride, the church. God must think a lot of marriage because he's the one who instituted the whole thing. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, the Lord said, "It is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." Only several verses later in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, we find these familiar words. "For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." All this points to the fact that God instituted marriage for the welfare of mankind. Since God is the one who instituted marriage, it should not be taken lightly. As you perform the wedding ceremony, remember that you are not merely fulfilling a sociological phenomenon, but are actually uniting two people in holy matrimony, a phenomenon which God himself began and which God himself sees as very, very important. Knowing the importance God places upon marriage, it is extremely sad to find so many couples seeking divorce. The divorce statistics are staggering, and the ramifications are almost beyond belief. Standards of living decrease, second marriages have a higher chance of divorce, and all the parties involved, from grandma to the children, are left disillusioned, heartbroken, frightened, and scarred for life. Feeling the weight of this tragedy, God says that he himself hates divorce in Malachi chapter 2, verse 16. As a representative of Christ, the minister stands in a strategic gap to challenge the erosion of the family and uplift the institution of marriage back to its proper pedestal. Before we discuss the ceremony itself, I believe it will be profitable to talk about premarital counseling. Most couples are not fully aware of the complexity and different dimensions of a marital relationship. The multifaceted marriage involves several dimensions in which the couple share an emotional, economic, recreational, social, geographical, sexual, legal, and religious arenas, to name a few. Some couples enter marriage for all the wrong reasons. Pregnancy. They are vulnerable because they're on the rebound. Rebellion. Escape. Loneliness. Physical factors. Guilt and pity. Social pressures and low self-esteem. They often idealize marriage, romance, and love based on what they see on TV and in the movies. Premarital counseling can address these issues and help the couple more clearly see through the foggy marriage myths. Find solid text on premarital counseling from authors you trust. Ask other ministers for advice. Read up on the area of premarital counseling so you can create a counseling approach that you like and one that is relevant to the needs of the day. I have used 5 counseling sessions with the sixth one coming 3 to 6 months after the couple have been married. You may need to adjust this depending upon the couple. Teenagers may need more counseling than older adults. The point is really not how many sessions you have or how many sessions you don't have. That's really to miss the point. The point is adequately covering the material based on the couple's need. I don't think it's wise to rigidly lock yourself into a set of sessions and feel like you failed if you didn't get 5 of them in. Be flexible enough to adjust the number of sessions to the ground the couple need to cover. Premarital counseling will need to cover several items, including what is marriage and love. We'll have to cover family background, sexual understanding, obviously Christian beliefs, individual uniqueness and acceptance, expectations in marriage, goals for a marriage, role clarification, conflict resolution, how to go about changing your mate, finances, children, in-laws, boy, that's a good one, communication, marital adjustments, and, of course, planning the ceremony. Becoming proficient with several of the available testing helps is indispensable. The Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis and Prepare and Enrich are valuable tools for discovering strengths and weaknesses to the relationship and possible hotspots in temperament differences. This can help bring about a greater understanding and tolerance of each other. The Family History Analysis is a fine tool for discovering the backgrounds of each person. Since individuals largely bring into marriage the behaviors and expectations modeled for them by their parents, this helps to point out possible trouble spots for discussion and awareness. Premarital counseling is invaluable for helping couples enter marriage more realistically, more fully aware of their strengths and weaknesses, and better able to build upon solid Christian foundations. The wedding rehearsal is usually a time when people are edgy and the situation is a little chaotic. And this is why it's important for you to have a handle on what is going on. The proficiency with which you handle the rehearsal will inevitably show up in the ceremony itself. Begin the rehearsal on time. To wait around on the straggly few is to irritate and offend the rest of the people. Reward those who arrive on schedule by beginning as close to the starting time as possible. And when you plan the rehearsal, give yourself plenty of leeway to meet the time commitments of the rehearsal dinner. I don't know how many couples I've seen rushed, extremely rushed to even get there. Normally, wedding rehearsals take about an hour to an hour and a half to complete. So set the beginning time 15 minutes before the time you really need to start. Allow yourself some flexibility. For instance, if the wedding rehearsal needs to begin by 6, set the time at 5:45. And this will provide you with time to fully rehearse and time for the wedding party to make their way to the rehearsal dinner. Really, it's better to have too much time than not enough. Second, gather pertinent information ahead of time. Meet with the couple, usually during the counseling session, to iron out details regarding the order of the processional, the seating of the family, who is doing what, and all the details of the ceremony. I created a checklist of all the details and information I felt I needed to properly perform the wedding. And it was of immense value. I tell the bride-to-be, that this is her special wedding day. And if any decisions arise or adjustments need to be made, hers will be the final decision. Not mom's, not dad's, or anybody else's. I've known ministers who wait until the rehearsal to figure anything out, and it's usually a long rehearsal that includes a great deal of tension and frustration and really is a waste of people's time. And there is absolutely no excuse for not being prepared. Obviously, there's going to be little adjustments that will be made here and there, but the greater the degree of your preparation through information gathering, the greater degree of success you will see in the wedding rehearsal. Third, begin introductions. The introduction time allows for people to get to know one another, learn the rules of the house, and to seek the Lord in prayer. So, normally, after introducing myself, I usually ask the bride to introduce everyone on her side of the family. Their relationship to her she needs to explain, and their part in the wedding. I then ask the groom to do the same. Something funny is usually said or done which kind of breaks the ice, and everybody begins to relax and feel a bit more comfortable. I then introduce those from the church helping with the wedding, such as a wedding hostess, a trustee, or a deacon, or a deaconess, and they are there to help the wedding party with any needs they might have. Next, I give some brief announcements, such as the place and time of the rehearsal dinner, the locations of the restrooms, any policies that should be stated, and the process and the purpose of our gathering. Then we pray, asking for God's help during the rehearsal, and that the wedding itself would bring honor and glory to His name. Fourth, since everyone is near the front, it is a good idea to begin the rehearsal by placing each person in the spot they will stand after the processional. Small pieces of tape may be used to mark the spot where each is to stand. You then proceed through the ceremony from that point onward. Some speak all the words and sing all the songs, while others just do a portion of them. I prefer the latter, since we just want to make sure everybody knows when they are to do their part. The recessional is walk-through, which puts everyone at the back of the church. There, you can rehearse the reception line. After that, you practice the processional and go through the whole thing again. So, in essence, everything is rehearsed twice with the exception of the processional. And by allowing yourself plenty of time for the rehearsal, rough spots can be rehearsed as often as needed to assure that everyone is comfortable with their role. Don't forget the ushers, the candle lighters, the flower girl, and the ring bearer. Near the end of the rehearsal, I have a special meeting with the ushers and candle lighters. I let them know that I will meet with them during the introduction so they don't panic and think they are forgotten. So we go over the mechanics of ushering and candle lighting to assure that this is done in a correct and professional manner. Are you going to start up front? Are you going to start with the middle aisles or the side aisles? Are you going to go with the candelabras from the inside out or from the outside in, or from the middle to the sides? All of that really needs to be talked about, because we want to make certain that it's done correctly in a professional manner. So you need to talk about what order should the candles be lit and how one should hold the lighter. What should be done if one goes out? Does the usher walk women to their seat? And if so, what is the proper way that this is to be done? What is the arrangement for seating? Is it everyone sits wherever they want, or is the guest of the bride going to sit on one side and guest of the groom on the other? When is the runner to be pulled? How should it be done? What should be done with latecomers? What is the proper way to dismiss the guest? The ushers and candlelighters feel much more comfortable with their duties if these items are discussed. Many weddings have been dulled because this detail was overlooked. I try to talk a little bit with the flower girl and ring bearer so they feel comfortable around me, so they're not scared. Familiarity helps if I have to get their attention during the wedding. I also find the mom or dad or someone to be responsible for them and detail in a kind way what their job is. If the child is acting up or begins to cry or something, I need someone there who can take in charge of them. Fifth, pay attention to detail. I attended a wedding where the couple was looking at the minister while saying their vows. And over his lapel mic, he said, "Don't say them to me, say them to each other." It must have been a very belittling moment for the couple to hear those words in front of so many people. Had the minister paid attention to detail, this event could have been avoided. Make sure they are facing one another during appropriate times in the service. I don't want them saying vows to me. I want them to say their vows to one another. Make sure the bridal bouquet is taken care of when the bride needs both hands free. Be sure someone cares for the train of her dress to avoid disaster. Help her move around up front. Remind the groomsmen how to stand. Make sure they're all standing the same way. Make certain the sound system is working properly. See, lack of attention to detail can dull even the brightest wedding. At the end of the rehearsal, the people are usually wound up and relieved that this portion of the ordeal is over. Now it's time to relax until tomorrow. And so it's a good time to thank everyone for coming and for practicing their part in the wedding, give some final announcements, if there are any, and then close the rehearsal with prayer. Traditionally, the rehearsal dinner comes after the rehearsal. However, many are placing the rehearsal dinner prior to the rehearsal. People are more relaxed and they've had time to get to know one another, which makes the rehearsal itself a little more relaxing. Rehearsal dinners can become a profitable time for building bridges with others who may not know Christ. And they often hold negative stereotypes of ministers. And so how you handle yourself can open doors for further ministry. Ministers can capitalize on the bridges that can be built during rehearsal dinners and receptions for furthering the gospel and ministering to others. Sometimes others will feel uncomfortable around you. They just don't know how to act around a minister, never been around a minister. What's a minister like? Is he so holy does he smile? Does he laugh? Is he normal? So to help them feel comfortable, let them know that you're open and that you're friendly. When you begin to use pious platitudes, all that does is build walls, not bridges. Additionally, tradition has the wedding party facing the minister with their backs to the congregation. I personally prefer to have my back to the congregation and the wedding party facing the congregation. They didn't come to see me. They came to see the wedding party. And instead of seeing their backs, they get to see their fronts. They get to see the smiles on their faces, the responses, the beautiful dresses and tuxedos. Now, I leave this decision to the couple, but I do bring it before them as an option. Some, out of fear, don't want to look at the congregation. They're scared to death as it is. And others, however, think this is an absolutely wonderful idea. The guests came to see them, not me. I don't know how many times someone has come to me and said, "I've never seen it done that way. That was really nice." Make certain that you take care of all legal concerns prior to the wedding. Call the appropriate authorities in your location, usually a county clerk who registers wedding licenses, and determine what you need to do to officially and legally perform weddings. States vary in their requirements, but usually you must register an official copy of your ordination papers. Secondly, you need to understand the licensing process for the bride and groom. Ask for information or an explanation of what the bride and groom are expected to do, how much it costs, and how long the license is good for, and where they can get a license, and what information will they need to bring with them. Ask if a blood test is required, and ask them how to receive a copy of the license after the wedding. See, you're going to want to make certain the couple has taken care of this long before the wedding. Third, learn how to properly fill out the wedding document. Since it is an official document, it cannot contain mistakes. Know what signatures are needed and where they are to be placed. And since there is usually a time frame within which you, as the servant of the state in this matter, must return the properly completed license, mail it back right away. To lose it under the papers on your desk or to somehow inadvertently forget about it could produce problems surrounding the legality of the marriage. To ensure that the legal issues are taken care of, I usually have the couple bring me the wedding license on rehearsal night. I take the time to fill it out as completely as possible prior to the wedding. I tell the witnesses, usually the best man and maid of honor, that I will need their signatures immediately following the service. The envelope of the completed license is addressed and ready to go. Taking care of these items, you see, prior to the wedding helps to ensure that legal matters are taken care of in a prompt and expeditious manner. This is the end of number 3.